This is a very strange and frustrating story. To have your family member stolen, murdered, then missing.
I'm Connie Walker, and this is Missing and Murdered, Finding Cleo.
It's such a mystery, such an impossible task. Please, help us find her.
Finding Cleo. If you'd like to hear more, you can find the full season wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Jamie Poisson.
The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 27-28-2024.
This week, for the first time since the start of the Gaza war, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. They did this after the U.S. abstained from voting, rather than vetoing, as they had in three previous resolutions. For many watching, this was a really big deal, and the strongest sign yet of a fracture in a long and special relationship the U.S. has with Israel. But is it really a fracture? Today, I'm speaking with The Guardian's World Affairs editor, Julian Borger, about that pivotal UN vote and whether it's just symbolic or if it means something more. Julian, hi. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
It's a pleasure.
So let's just walk through what this vote actually was on Monday. What was this resolution calling for?
It called for an immediate ceasefire during the remainder of Ramadan and a ceasefire that should, it said, lead on to something more lasting and sustainable. At the same time, it also demanded the release of hostages by Hamas and a substantial increase in the delivery of humanitarian aid into Gaza.
Mm-hmm. The way I understood part of it was that a difference between this resolution and one that the U.S. had tried and failed to pass earlier was that this didn't condition the call for the ceasefire on the release of the hostages, right? There were two separate demands. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
That's right. Up to that point, the U.S. had always insisted on tight linkage between there being a ceasefire and there being the release of hostages. The U.S. has said the way to a ceasefire is through the hostage negotiations that have been underway on and off and are currently underway in Doha that link the two, ceasefire for the release of hostages with the Palestinians detained by the Israelis put into the mix as well. Mm-hmm. And as you rightly said, that the resolution passed on Monday demanded an immediate ceasefire and also demanded the hostages. So putting them in parallel, but not linking them.
Right, right. So unlike in three previous ceasefire resolutions since the start of this war, the U.S., as I mentioned, they didn't veto it. They abstained. And briefly, what has the U.S. said about why they didn't veto this time around?
They said that what the resolution expressed was in line with their basic requirements, that they agreed that it was necessary to have a ceasefire. They agreed it was necessary to release the hostages. They insisted there wasn't a real change in policy, but they had held up a ceasefire resolution for several months because they objected to any resolution that didn't link ceasefires with hostage release tightly. And also, they had objected to a succession of resolutions that did not condemn Hamas for the 7th of October attacks on Israeli civilians. But the resolution on Monday didn't do that either. The U.S. at the very last moment tried to get that in. It was made clear that it would disrupt the passing of the resolution and all the delegates would have to go back to their capitals and so on. And so they dropped the demand. So the two important things that the U.S. had demanded, required until Monday, that they dropped.
Mm-hmm. observers who follow this closely, how significant was it that there was a departure from these two things that they had been pursuing before and that they abstained on Monday?
Well, it's symbolically very important because for so many months, a ceasefire resolution, something that many thought that the Security Council should have done immediately, as it's supposed to safeguard international peace and security. There was a feeling that this is the minimum the Security Council could do in the face of the bloodshed in Gaza. But the Security Council failed for 5 months to come to any kind of consensus and to express the need for a ceasefire. So to be able to do just that was a breakthrough. It's another question of what it will mean in the real world. And that really is to be determined and not straightforward at all.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get into that with you more in a few minutes. But it might be worth us noting here that this history of the United States vetoing Security Council resolutions, it didn't start with this war, right? Since 1972, the U.S. has vetoed a total of 48 Security Council resolutions related to Israel, the majority of them concerning the Israel-Palestinian situation. And just, I wonder if you could give me a little bit more historical context there.
Well, for a long while, a long time at the UN, the United States has been a shield for Israel against the rest of the international community. And that acting as a shield has been one of the important diplomatic dimensions of this very close relationship. And it is very rare for the U.S. to drop that shield. It happened under the Obama administration on one issue, but it is very rare.
And just why the decision to abstain on the ceasefire vote now, you think?
I think because the clock is ticking.
Northern Gaza, penned in with no safe place to turn, people are already starving to death. People will die, says Umrami Al-Sawirki. They're killing people for 5 kilograms of flour. For God's sake, look at us.
And it is a question of days, weeks, and people are already dying. So it is very clear that there isn't much time left to hope for some kind of ideal situation. And I think that has been weighing on this administration. There has people in it like Samantha Power, the head of USAID, who wrote a book about genocide and about the U.S. capacity and willingness to step in and stop it. The Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, is reportedly very concerned, uneasy about the looming humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. So is the U.S. envoy to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, and the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin. They've all expressed great concern about this impending calamity. Mm-hmm. And so there were strains within the Biden administration keeping this policy of defense of Israel together.
You know, I'm also thinking of some other indications of criticism from the U.S. government, in addition to the people that you mentioned. You know, when I was listening to you talk just now, I was thinking about the speech from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way. As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th.
But he was very critical of Netanyahu, and he effectively called for a change of leadership in Israel. And Biden later called it a good speech. And, you know, are these signs of a wider shift in how the Democrats are thinking about their relationship with the Israeli government?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's been an earthquake in the Democratic Party because the political calculus is no longer the same. They're losing a lot of support among Arab Americans, among young progressive voters. It has really beginning to affect them. And you saw Democratic primary, the number of uncommitted votes that were protest votes. So this is becoming an important and to some extent divisive issue within the party, to some extent divisive among generations, an elder generation of Democrats who are just more like Joe Biden himself, instinctively, viscerally attached to Israel and Israeli security, that younger Americans, younger Democrats just don't feel.
Yeah. I just saw a new Gallup poll that found just 36% of Americans approve of Israel's military action in Gaza. But I think importantly, a majority, 55%, actually said that they disapproved, which feels, you know, quite significant. But you know, at the same time, Julian, this government, the Biden administration, is not saying that they're going to stop sending military aid to Israel or financial aid to Israel. So, you know, how much of this is just talk?
That's a really good question. I mean, the symbolism and what is said on the world stage is important. It's important both globally and within Israeli politics itself. But yes, the question is, will it help get food through the gates into Gaza, which is the critical question now? And no, there is no direct transmission mechanism between that vote and food getting across. That remains a question of how much leverage does the US in particular have on this Israeli government, because they've been asking for the gates to be opened and for the various obstacles to the delivery of aid to be lifted. And that leverage has not worked until now. And many people think, many analysts think, that the only thing that would make a difference is the threat to restrict the weapon supplies on which Israel depends. But that in turn would be politically a big step in the US political scene. And it would leave President Biden and Democrats open to inevitable claims that they were somehow letting Israel down, leaving it defenseless in a hostile neighborhood. And that is the allegation that the Biden and the Democratic leadership are cautious about. And that is the political calculus that lies behind this.
And I suppose it might be worth saying here that, you know, the administration probably also shares some of the same goals as Israel, and that they have stated that they would like to see Hamas dismantled here as well.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, there is a looming enemy to the north in the shape of Hezbollah, which is far better armed than Hamas, has over 100,000 rockets and missiles reputedly, who could overwhelm Israel's missile defenses. And it is, to some extent, the concern that that could happen, that Hezbollah could enter the fray if Israel was weakened by the interruption in U.S. weapons supplies. It's that worry that lies behind some of the cautiousness on the part of this administration in trying to use that lever of restricting the flow of arms.
Hey, it's Jeff Blair.
And I'm Kevin Barker.
Join us for in-depth coverage on everything surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays and the biggest stories across Major League Baseball with the best guests in the game and, of course, first-class analysis.
Ha! That's the smartest thing you've ever said, Jeff.
See what I have to put up with? It's Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, we've been talking about how, you know, U.S. officials are increasingly more critical of Israel. But, like, I think it's also important for us to talk about how They also seem to be kind of tying themselves in knots right now to do both things at the same time. So I saw this clip yesterday of State Department spokesperson Matt Miller trying to explain why the U.S. is saying the resolution that we're talking about is non-binding when all U.N. Security Council resolutions are legally binding. And it just kind of ended up being incoherent.
When we say the resolution is non-binding, what we mean is that it does not impose any new obligations on the parties, the way, for example, some UN resolutions that impose obligatory sanctions, impose actual requirements on people to implement them. That said,
yes, they are tying themselves in knots. The majority view of scholars, certainly of UN member states and the UN institution itself, is that strong words like there were in this resolution, demanding action, it does represent a decision by the Security Council and is therefore binding.
This idea that they're tying themselves in knots, are there any examples that you think are notable that you've seen lately? Any other examples?
Yes, in particular, the beginning of the week where you had the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, greeting his Israeli counterpart at the Pentagon. And telling him in public that Gaza was facing a humanitarian catastrophe, and it was their first priority to get humanitarian aid in. And at almost the same time, over at the State Department, you had the State Department spokesman Matthew Miller saying that there was no reason for the U.S. currently to dispute Israeli formal assurances that its conduct of the war and its provision of humanitarian aid were according to international humanitarian law.
Look, these are all, like, when you come to the use of weapons, it's a determination you have to make with respect to individual strikes or individual campaigns or individual acts. And so we have had ongoing assessments to look at some of those, and in none of those have we yet found violations of international humanitarian law.
I mean, it is clear that U.S. officials, Lloyd Austin included, do not believe that the level of provision of humanitarian assistance is in line with international law and international norms. Mm-hmm. So there is a good deal of dissonance in U.S. Middle East policy right now. And it is a question of whether, you know, how long it can withstand the strain without a significant change in direction.
Let's talk about the Israeli side of this now. So how has Netanyahu responded to the U.S. abstention?
With great anger. He said it was a retreat of the U.S. position at the U.N. and that the U.S. was abandoning its position. And he canceled a delegation that was due to go out to Washington early this week and discuss Israel's planned offensive on Rafah. These were potentially very important discussions because the U.S. doesn't want Israel to go ahead with that offensive. And so he called off that visit in a sign of disapproval. And it's sort of bringing the rift in that bilateral relationship very much to the surface.
How isolated is Israel finding itself on the world stage right now?
Very isolated. It is obviously the U.S. shield was critical to it in terms of avoiding this kind of Security Council resolution, but it was already very isolated in the broader arena in the General Assembly. It has very few friends left as this war goes on. Another friend who is distancing itself quite noticeably is also Germany, which is the second biggest supplier of arms, second by a long way, but still second, and has been, because of the past, because of the history, very averse to criticism of Israel. But Germany, too, is getting more and more uneasy as this war unfolds.
I thought it was significant that even Donald Trump, who, you know, when he was in power, was extremely vocal in his support for the Israeli government, said earlier this week.
Now we got to get to peace. You can't have this going on. And I will say Israel has to be very careful because you're losing a lot of the world. You're losing a lot of support. But you have to finish up. You have to get the job done. And you have to get on to peace. You have to get on to...
Though he did tell them to finish up your war, whatever that means. And what does that say to you?
Well, clearly that whatever other faults he has, Trump knows how to read the room. And the room in the international community is very hostile at the moment to Israel because of this war. You have Russia, China, and most of the great powers who are outwardly condemning Israel's acts. And now with the U.S. becoming more tepid, he knows that it's not a sustainable position for the Israelis to be in.
Mm-hmm. This was something that you mentioned earlier, but I wonder, just to end this conversation, if we could get into it a little bit more. You know, we're talking about the shift in the relationship and the rhetoric between the U.S. and Israel. But, you know, fundamentally, is there any indication right now that any of this, the U.S.'s tough talk, the U.N. Security Council vote, any of it will actually change anything on the ground in Gaza?
No, I think that really the only thing that could change Israeli policy is either a sudden change in the Israeli government. That's one thing. But that's unlikely to happen while hostilities are still underway. The second thing is a threat, a credible threat from the U.S. that it would start constricting the supply of arms, because nothing else so far has worked in terms of getting a substantial amount of aid into Gaza, and in particular northern Gaza, where the threat of famine is the most severe.
Julian, thank you very much for this. It's always really great to have you on.
Thank you. A pleasure.
All right, that is all for today. I'm Jamie Poisson. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you tomorrow.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.